So tonight's talk, I actually gave the title "Wisdom: The Fruit of Practice." Think about what we've covered so far. This is the fourth part, I mean, right? First three sort of laid the groundwork. Generosity and virtue got our life in order in the world. Through renunciation, we sort of acknowledge the importance of actually practicing and diligently doing so, and reorganizing our life to have more time to do that. We let go of some things so we can have time for practice. And then the wisdom is what results from that practice. And though, 'cause those, all those things are practices, right? So I want to read a little thing from the Dhammapada to start with here. This is verse 282 of the Dhammapada. From practice comes wisdom. From not practicing, wisdom's end. Knowing these two courses, development or decline, conduct yourself so wisdom will grow. So once again, this is a practice. We can actually practice in a sense, or experience the beauty of wisdom as it arises. And basically, what I want to do in this talk is start by sort of giving you a classic definition of it, and go through that classic definition. And then I've got a collection of things that other people have said about wisdom that I want to share with you and discuss them in some ways and put them into the context of this. But classically, it's said that there are three kinds of wisdom: that which arises from study, that which arises from reflection on what you've been has been studied, and that which arises from meditative practice itself. So the wisdom arising from studying the Dhamma, it's called knowledge, typically, right? So, but study is, from my point of view anyway, an essential part of this practice. The knowledge gain helps you to recognize what is arising in the moment and gives you a framework or a point of reference. It helps you sort of fit things together, right? Gives you a good idea of what direction you want to actually go in. The problem with this sort of wisdom, however, is it's primarily mental. It gives you a set of ideas to believe in. So you now you have a set of beliefs based on what you studied. But you haven't actually experienced it. You've just read about it, or heard about it listening to the Dharma talks, or however you absorb this, right? So you may intellectually understand what you've read or heard, but you don't know it in the capital K no sense. It's, you haven't experienced it yet, which is when wisdom arises from the experience itself. So it's valuable. Study's valuable because it gives you a context for what's arising, what you're experiencing as you practice. It gives you, oh, it's like I found this very often. It's like I'll be sitting and something arises in my mind, and I go, oh, that's, like that thing I was reading about in that book 2 months ago or whatever. We make those connections because we have that base of knowledge to start with. So that's the first layer of wisdom is knowledge. It comes arises from study. And then there's something, reflection is a process of looking at the knowledge you've gained from study and consciously challenging it. Like, don't, just because it's written in some book that you, by someone you respect even, don't believe anything. Certainly, if you can try and look at it from very, try and see it from various angles or different perspectives. So sometimes reflection is done when you're alone, perhaps by, reading or studying from different sources. But it's also very often reflection arises when you gather with a group of like-minded people and you have a sort of an open to and fro discussion. Because often, you know, in those sorts of situations where these are people you respect and they have different opinions than you, different ideas than you about what's being taught, it's like, oh, gee, I never thought of it quite that way before. And it allows you to sort of refine what you've studied and have a clearer understanding of it. As long as you have an open mind in the midst of these discussions and reflections. The danger is you read something, you say, this is it. This is what, you know, so-and-so says, and he's my man, or she's my woman, and this is the person I trust. And then someone says something different, and you just, oh no, that's not what so-and-so said. So we have to be very open-minded when we go through this process of reflecting on the Dhamma, and sort of understand that we might shift in one direction or another based on what we're hearing and from talking to others. This points very directly to the importance of Sangha. The idea that you have, people you are connected to, who you hang out with, who are people you trust and people who you feel comfortable discussing the Dhamma with. There's this great sutta where there's these three bhikkhus who live together in this little area, and the Buddha comes to talk to them and see how they're doing. So the teacher's coming to check them out, basically, see how they're, and when he goes through how they're practicing and this and that. And one thing they say is they're really, really consciously trying to keep silent all the time. So they have developed a few simple hand signals, can you come and help me empty the waste bucket sort of thing, the day-to-dayness of it, right? But then they said, and so we, as much as possible, stay silent and stay with the practice and practice throughout the day. But every 5 days, we stay up all night discussing the Dhamma. This was part of their practice. This was like they consciously chose to have a time, a regular time for reflection, where they had this interchange between these three bhikkhus. So it's like, this isn't, it's, it was, what was, an, and the Buddha, of course, said, oh, good idea. The Buddha approved of it, of course. So, but here's the problem. This wisdom is still on the level of discursive thought. It's still on the level of words. It might be, has become refined. It has become, you have a clear understanding of what you've been studying. You've reflected on it. You've sort of let it stew. But it still needs to be integrated into the level of personal experience, which is the third form of wisdom, which is wisdom that arises directly out of insights gained from meditative practice. This is sort of the blossoming of right understanding. Right understanding being the first step on the path where we, oh yeah, that makes sense, so I should do something about it. But now wisdom is sort of like that understanding, which often pretty much at least originally arose strictly from study, from reading things or listening to Dharma talks or listening to what someone said. We start to see and experience the truth of those teachings. We start to actually experience the three characteristics, right? Unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not self. And we start to see that as being how things really are. I mean, one definition of this practice is to just see things as they truly are. We start to see that that's the case, that things are unsatisfactory, our conventional life and our conventional way of seeking happiness is unsatisfactory because it's all based on the idea that some things are permanent and everything is impermanent. So how can any way of being great, making ourselves happy, be work if it's based on things that are impermanent and constantly changing all the time? It's a contradiction that doesn't make sense, right? And we start to see that because we start to see how everything is impermanent. We start to see how things are arising and they're there for a while and they're gone. That's what we're actually seeing at the level of practice. And that makes us understand the unsatisfactoriness of what's going on as a source of happiness. And it doesn't work, this idea of having stuff or getting things or getting knowledge. I got to watch that one even. It doesn't work as a way to make us permanently happy because it's always changing. It never stays still. And because everything, then even that happiness, which we, and sure enough, reading sometimes, I read something and I go, wow, is that ever cool? So there's that momentary happiness. I'm not saying that reading and study doesn't have those moments of happiness, of joy even, but it's like, it's transitory. And it's transitory because not only is the what's happening changing, but you're changing. Moment to moment, we think, oh, well, everything else is changing, I'm permanent, right? But I'm changing all the time. And so how I experience things is changing literally moment to moment. So once again, how is that possibly going to work as a way to make myself happy? It's just this idea of grasping or pushing away that we're constantly involved in our mind is aimed at bolstering our self-image. The idea that we're somehow a permanent entity. This is my stuff. This isn't my stuff. This is who I am. This is not who I am. This is all this, that process that we go through all the time. It's just creating a sense of a separate self. We do it all the time. I mean, if you really look at what you're doing all day long, what you're doing a lot of the time is what one of my teachers calls selfing. The process of creating more images of a separate self over and over and over again. And wisdom is starting to see that that's true. And it might be just a little flicker. it's this idea of a separate self is really hard to grasp. And actually in one place in the sutta, the Buddha said that the very last thing before his great enlightenment, sitting there under the Bodhi tree, the last thing he had to let go of was a subtle sense of a separate self. That was what had to go at the end. After he'd gotten, you know, dealt with all the other issues, there was still that sense of a separate self. And that's what was his last thing that he had to let go of. His last renunciation, in a sense. And instead, we think everything else is changing. I can sort of understand that. Sure, everything's changing, but I'm not. You know, but I mean, thinking about aging a lot lately. I'm about to turn 75. And it's like, wow, you know, I've been living in Boulder for 20 years now, in this house. In this, I was just talking about, I've been living in this same house for 20 years, which is like, for me, like really a record, right? And it's like, look at all the things that have changed in those 20 years. You know, it's just like that. But 20 years has gone by. And everything, you know, this, certainly my hair was, actually had more hair and it was a different color than it is now. Just for a start. But you know, and we start to see through this, the wisdom that's arising, that we're connected to everything, that we're not separate at all. And we have the little tiny bits of that wisdom arising. And then over time, they accumulate into a larger bit. And then, but it's a process. And that's why we call this practice. Because this isn't like, you know, one day, you know, the light goes on. Oh, I got it. I don't have a separate self. You know, intellectually that might happen. But in reality, it's an ongoing process that this takes time. So that's the idea of wisdom, you know, this idea of knowledge, of reflection, and then of the wisdom that arises out of practice through insight. Why they call this insight meditation, right? but I want to sort of look at what other people have to say about this topic. And I want to start by looking at Ajahn Susito's book, Parami, since this is a talk about the Paramis, right? And he has a slightly different take on some of these things. But he's talking about the fact that it almost sounds like, you know, I study, I reflect, I meditate. You know, it's a straight line somehow. And it's not at all. And he's talking about how really this whole practice is very, very cyclical. In a way, these three are sequential, although not quite as straightforward as first A, then B, then C. The way that they generally come into play is that you get in some advice, make a considered effort, and get some degree of realization. There's enough clear seeing to give you confidence in the theory, so you make more of the mind accessible for further application. And then you can subsequently broaden or deepen the realization. The process loops around, but it begins with the mapping out of a basis for inquiry into cause and effect. We investigate what is for our long-term benefit rather than our short-term gain. What is for our welfare and the welfare of others and leads to peace? What kind of immediate happiness actually causes us unhappiness in the long run? And what are the causes or triggers for these trajectories? We don't always apply our wisdom to our impulses, such as overspending, incompatible relationships, or substance abuse, because as ideas and impulses, they all feel good at the time. Just to know that you have a reliable resource and can map out where you're going is really a kind of release, a release from being clueless. I love Ajahn Susito. He's very colloquial and earthy in some of his language sometimes. So this, I mean, he's talking to this, like, we get a little knowledge, we reflect a little, we get a little deeper wisdom arising out of practice, and that leads us back to, oh, a deeper understanding of the knowledge itself. And then we dig a little deeper into that. You know, we look further into the teachings. And then we reflect on that for a while, and then we're going around in these cycles over and over again. I wrote a whole bunch of articles about the Paramis 12, 13 years ago, and one of them I talked about the practice being a spiral. And of all the things I've ever written, that's the one that gets quoted. I mean, I keep getting emails. I mean, like 13 years ago, I wrote this thing. I still get emails every once in a while saying, "Hi, can I quote that?" I understand you said, and you know, I was like, sure, you know, but it's something about that idea that it's in a spiral. This practice is not linear in any sense at all. That sort of just makes intuitive sense to people, I think. It's like, oh yeah, I can see that makes sense. That, you know, there's an image, I think, I forget whose image, you know, we sometimes talk about this practice as going up the mountain, right? You were sort of going up higher and higher and higher and higher. And the image that this person used was, no, this is like a giant pit mine. Have you ever seen a pit mine? It's like a big hole in the ground, and there's a track that runs around the outside of it, spiraling further and further down. We dig deeper with this practice until we get to the bottom of things. It's just an interesting image, but it's there. There's that spiral again. You just keep going round and round and round and round and end up at the core. It's just, I like that image. That's why I mentioned it. So that's one thing Ajahn Sisitu has to say about wisdom. But he puts a great emphasis on something else here. And I think this is also where what wisdom means, in a sense, in this tradition. And also I want to read another section here. Wisdom in meditation comes through handling and evaluating our experience in terms of how it affects our mental awareness. Insights looks at whether sights, sounds, thoughts, or attitudes feel rough, tight, or bright, whether they bring around a contracted and stressful state of being or an open and released state. As you pick up the marks of the unskillful or the skillful from the state of your mind and you see how they arise, insight develops. Your wisdom takes on an embodied heart and gut knowing, which is clear and gets to the point, such as, I feel like the problem isn't the people want me a lot from me. It's more that I'm a compulsive doer. I demand too much of myself. For this felt knowing, you have to calm the mind and inquire with reflective awareness rather than think about yourself. Then you can see, this is suffering. This is the cause is a craving to be some state or another. There can be a letting go of that craving. That is how to bring it about. You get a personal read on the Four Noble Truths, suffering, origin, ceasing, and path. This is also wisdom, seeing what's skillful, what's useful, and what isn't. The methods of letting go of the cause of suffering provide an ongoing path, the fourth truth. We focus on this process in formal meditation exercises and also in daily life. It's about knowing the good and living it out, knowing the bad and steering away from it, and being aware of the results. Then through acquiring the results of goodness, one begins to feel clear and in tune with the goodness. One can see when there's something dissonant. Maybe we see a grudge or a demand we make on ourselves, or how we identify with a role or a function, and adopt an inner verdict of being a success or a failure. However, when mental awareness clearly discerns, all this is something that passes through awareness. These are states that I can step back from. We see the stress and the possibility for release. Then with that release, we feel the quiet happiness of clarity and confidence. And with that, the pressure abates. If you let this process unfold, you'll find that you do good things not because of some identity with being good, but just because it feels good in a reliable and holistic way. I love this. It isn't about the identity of being good, it's that it feels good. This is good for others and good for me. You feel confident about doing good. You aren't embarrassed by it. You don't feel your acts of goodness are inadequate, useless, or pointless, or that somebody else can do better. It doesn't matter whether anyone else can do better or if anyone else notices or cares. What is of immediate and discernible relevance is whether your own mind is in a skillful or an unskillful state. So wisdom as a perfection gives us our own ground. It is the discernment to feel what is right and what is wrong in a truly intrinsic way rather than through a competitive I'm better than you are. This is the only way by us. And the result is that aware intelligence rather than self-image governs the heart. Wonderful advice. So that's Ajahn Sisitu. Also, I want to share some things from Joseph Goldstein. This is from his book, Mindfulness. He's talking once again about wisdom. And it says, and this is actually in a section where he's talking about the seven factors of awakening. He's talking about what mindfulness is, in a sense. The last aspect of mindfulness is its close association with wisdom. This comes about through bare attention and clear comprehension. So quality of bare attention can manifest on different levels and is called different things in various Buddhist traditions. Mindfulness, naked awareness, innate wakefulness. It is naked and bare because it is simple, direct, non-interfering, and non-judging. It's not making up stories about experience. It's just the simple awareness of things as they are. We can bring this simplicity to our meditation practice. But sometimes in our practice, we're looking for something special, and we miss this simplicity and overlook what is right in front of us. The power and strength of bare attention comes not from special experiences, but from a sustained and continuous awareness. We're not looking for any particular experience, for the breath or the body to be a special way. Rather, we're simply listening to, being aware of, and receiving the contact of whatever presents itself. It's like listening to a new piece of music when you're relaxed and attentive at the same time. It's not hard to be mindful. It just takes time training to remember to be mindful. I love that. This takes time to remember to be mindful. The other aspect of mindfulness closely associated with wisdom and conducive to its arising is called clear comprehension. This means seeing something precisely, thoroughly, from all sides. Clear comprehension broadens the practice of bare attention from a narrow focus to one that can see things in context. Mindfulness of activities, discussed in some detail in the four aspects of clear comprehension, knowing the purpose or the motivation of an action, knowing the suitability of the action, knowing the proper domain for mindfulness, and understanding non-delusion. This is Joseph at his best. He mentions something here that I think is actually quite relevant. He talks about seeing things from all sides. It's sort of part of what clear comprehension is. This is the Dalai Lama from the book. It's called The Book of Joy. And he's talking about exactly the same sort of thing. More in our daily life, I think, than in practice, he's talking about here, but I think it applies equally to both situations. So here, this is the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama used the term wider perspective and larger perspective. They involve stepping back within our own minds to look at the bigger picture and to move beyond our limited self-awareness and our limited self-interest. Every situation we confront in life comes from the convergence of many contributing factors. The Dalai Lama had explained, we must look at any given situation or problem from the front and from the back and from the sides and from the top and the bottom. So from at least six different angles. This allows us to take a more complete and holistic view of reality. And if we do so, our response will be more constructive. We suffer from a perceptible myopia. As a result, we are left nearsighted, unable to see our experience in a larger way. When we confront a challenge, we often react to the situation with fear and anger. The stress can make it hard for us to step back and see other perspectives and solutions. This is natural, the Archbishop, he's in dialogue with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. This is natural, the Archbishop emphasized throughout the week. But if we try, we can become less fixated or attached, to use the Buddhist term, to one outcome and can use more skillful means to handle the situation. We see that in the most seemingly limited circumstances, we are free choice and freedom, even if that freedom is ultimately the attitude we will take. How can trauma lead to growth and transformation? How can a negative event actually become positive? We're being invited to see the blessing in the curse and the joy in the sorrow. Like the wider perspective. And it's just like trying not to get fixated, which is a danger in practice as well. We sort of get fixated like, oh, this is the way it should be, or this is how it is. And we start to think that it always has to be that way. But since everything, including our practice, oh, what a surprise, is changing all the time, we have to sort of not be fixated into any sort of idea that it should be a certain way or it has to be this way or this is the only right way. It's very easy to get caught in those unwise ways of thinking about things. This is also from Joseph. And he's talking about investigation of dhammas, which is once again one of the seven factors of awakening. And it arises directly out of mindfulness. Investigation of dhammas is the wisdom aspect of the mind. And it means both directly experiencing the nature of phenomena and seeing how this experience correlates with the broad scope of the Buddhist teachings. For example, through mindfulness and investigation, we begin to see and realize for ourselves what are skillful mind states and what are not. Here we are no longer working from book knowledge, but rather the wisdom of our own experience. So he's talking very directly about those intuitive insights that arise, the wisdom that arises once mindfulness has arisen. Remember, mindfulness in and of itself is just another mind state that arises, and it might be there for a while, and then it's going to go away. That's also the nature of mindfulness. And so, you know, everything we're doing in terms of practice is simply trying to create the causes and conditions such that mindfulness will arise. We can't make ourselves mindful. We can only make ourselves practice in a skillful way so that the mind goes still and concentrated and mindfulness can arise. That's how it works. And then once mindfulness has arisen, then this investigative power of the mind, this powerful reflective nature of the mind itself, this is sort of reflection, like I talked about earlier, but on a different level, on a different scale, because it's very intuitive. We start, like I said earlier, we start to see the three poisons, right? But we don't get caught in them anymore. We can see them. You know, we can just see the three things that are arising and falling away, and we can see that they're impermanent, and we can see that impermanence, we create our own suffering. But it's now not an idea, it's something that we see at some very clear and precise way that's not intellectual. It's not understanding in that sense at all. It's a different way of seeing things. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that, I mean, I can use all these words, but I can't really explain it. It's just something you experience, and when you experience it, you know, that's what that was. Sure enough, now I see it clearly. It's a different process in a sense. So we have these three forms of wisdom, right? Arising from study, from reflection, and from mindfulness practice itself. And they're connected. They're all interwoven. And I say, you know, in one sense, one leads to the next, But in the others, like they interact with each other all the time. So it's, like I said, not a straight line. It's a process. And that's a good way to think about this whole practice. This practice isn't a thing, it's a process. We're engaging in the process of mindfulness. And so all we can do is study and reflect and practice. That's what's up to us. Yeah. But I want to point out one other thing. And this is once again from Joseph, and this is from his book, Insight Meditation. And he's talking, and the danger of everything I've just said, here's the yellow warning flag, is we get fixated that wisdom, that's where it's all at. Wisdom is what we need. And certainly we do need wisdom, but this is what Joseph has to say. Wisdom and love are the two great wings of Dhamma. Whether we are in a swirl of a busy life or in a deep, still silence of retreat, a clear mind and an open heart are the paramount forces we cultivate as both the means and the end of our path. These wonderful qualities of mind and heart are not exclusive virtues of renunciates and Asian masters. They are universal powers, and they show up in the most unlikely places. In some ways, an active layperson's life provides us with continual opportunities for not only cultivating, but also manifesting wisdom and love. And so that's the thing I wanted to make sure this was said and pointed out, because so often, especially in our culture, in our Western culture, where it's all about understanding and figuring things out, that we forget that this is heart mind. It isn't just mind, it's heart mind. And it's that balance of those two that somehow we have to find, where they have, you know, like he says, it's the two wings of Dhamma. Like Dhamma flies along on these two wings. And if you only ever see a bird fly with one wing, it just never works, right? You got to have two wings to fly. And so we have to be careful not to sort of think that somehow or other it's all about wisdom. Wisdom is important, absolutely important. But it's association with an open heart is equally important. They're tied together very strongly, and we should never forget that. And of course, I have a little bit of poetry here. This is a different Dana Falls book than I often read from. This one is called One Soul. It's the second of her books. And this one is called Intimate with All Things, which I quite like. This is, the Buddha said, "I am intimate with all things." Imagine that, to be on the same close terms with suffering and panic as bliss and rapture. To know the soul of water buffalo as surely as my own. To push away nothing. To let the sweet or bitter taste of life linger, to see the beloved in everything, and when that isn't my experience, to be intimate with self-hatred, unmet preferences, and the many ways I don't show up as saintly. Imagine that.